Okay, thank you. Okay, so the first part of the title was about PT symmetric quantum theory, and this is not a talk on PT symmetric quantum theory, but it does, that is part of the background to this talk. So I'm just going to summarize it in just a couple of minutes. The idea of PT symmetric quantum theory is to replace the mathematical condition of hermeticity by something a little bit weaker, and that is the idea of PT symmetry, and this is a much more physical condition, less mathematical sounding. P stands for parity, as you know, T stands for time reversal, and I say that this is a more physical condition because P and T are elements of the Lorentz group. And if you extend the real Lorentz group to the complex Lorentz group, the PT operator comes up naturally as the analytic continuation. Okay. So here are some examples in quantum mechanics of PT symmetric theories. And let me, I like this. So this is an example of a PT invariant Hamiltonian. It is PT invariant because under parity, x changes sign, but under time reversal, I changes sign. So that Hamiltonian is invariant under PT reflection. Okay? And what is interesting about this is that the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian as a function of epsilon, epsilon is a real parameter, as a function of epsilon, the eigenvalues are strictly real and positive and discrete. Okay, and this is a surprising and unusual result if you haven't seen this before. Okay, and this is something that we published some time ago. Here are some specific examples of that Hamiltonian. If you let that parameter epsilon be one, you get this cubic Hamiltonian, and again, its spectrum is strictly real and positive and discrete. And if you let epsilon equal 2, you get this quartic Hamiltonian. And again, the eigenvalues are strictly real, positive, and discrete. And this is surprising because this is an upside-down potential. And you might think that this would be impossible, that an upside-down potential cannot bind eigenvalues, but it does. Okay, and this is a rigorous result. The boundary conditions are, I would love to go into the details on it, so let me just say a word. The boundary conditions are that the eigenfunctions have to vanish in the appropriate Stokes sectors, and I will talk about that during the question period if you like. But I want to get to the main subject of this, so, but just to, yeah. In general, if you have a PT symmetric Hamiltonian, the what you know is that the secular equation is real, and therefore the eigenvalues occur either in complex conjugate pairs or else they are strictly real. Okay. Maybe we could reserve that for the question session, okay, because I really don't want to get into a deep discussion of PT symmetric quantum mechanics. But I just want to emphasize that the spectrum of that Hamiltonian is discrete and real and positive and parity symmetry is broken. Okay, so I'm standing here telling you that. If you want to see a proof, a rigorous demonstration that the eigenvalues are real, you can read this. This is a rather long paper, but it's worth reading, okay? What I want to argue is that PT symmetry is a way of controlling instabilities in a theory, and physical systems that you might think are unstable become stable in the complex domain, okay? And the minus x to the 4 potential is one example of that. So here is a minus x to the 4 potential, and you can read, it is really quite easy to prove that the eigenvalues are real and positive and discrete, and at the level of freshman calculus, here is a proof. Okay, so you might ask, what about epsilon equals 2? But in fact, it's true. So PT symmetric quantum mechanics has been used in lots of examples. It has described lots of theories where instabilities come in, for example, the stability of the Higgs vacuum, the stability of the double scaling limit in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, in Liouville quantum field theory. But here, I would like to talk about something completely different, okay? And in fact, I've written a bunch of papers on PT symmetry, and I wanted to take a vacation and work on something completely different, okay, having nothing to do with PT symmetry. And this has to do with instabilities associated with nonlinear eigenvalue problems. And I'm going to have to explain to you what I mean by a nonlinear eigenvalue problem. Okay, so to get into the mood, let's remember what we know about linear eigenvalue problems, standard eigenvalue problems for a time-independent Schrödinger equation. So what you know is that for such a problem, WKB gives a good approximation for large eigenvalues. This is the WKB formula. And in general, for a typical polynomial potential, for example, the nth energy level grows like a constant times the power of n. For example, for the harmonic oscillator, the eigenvalues grow linearly in n. For the anharmonic oscillator, they grow like n to the 4/3 times a constant, and WKB tells you that constant. So the constant is this, comes from evaluating a beta function integral, okay? For that PT symmetric Hamiltonian that I showed you, you can also use WKB, and leading order WKB is extremely accurate, and it gives you, for large n, it gives you this formula for the eigenvalues. So again, you see that there's a power of n, okay, times a constant, okay? So linear eigenvalue problems are an example of asymptotics beyond all orders, because if you write down this linear Schrödinger equation and you ask, how does the solution behave for large positive x? Of course, in general, the solution is a growing exponential at infinity. Okay? It's a growing exponential at infinity. And you can expand this as a full series in inverse powers of x, and you will only see one arbitrary constant. Why is that? Of course, this is a second-order equation, and there is another arbitrary constant, but that constant is invisible if you are only doing Poincaré asymptotics. It occurs, of course, in the subdominant solution, and you can see this subdominant solution in the special case that that you require that the eigenfunction vanish at infinity, okay? But you understand, and this is the solution that you get now. You get something that is vanishing exponentially at infinity. WKB gives you this result. But the point is that this solution is unstable. I want to emphasize that, unstable under very small changes in E. You make the tiniest change in the parameter E, and suddenly this solution is gone, and what you see is a solution that's growing at infinity. Okay. So, as you know, for a linear eigenvalue problem, there are three characteristic properties. One, that the solution is oscillatory in the classically allowed region. There's a monotone decay in the classically forbidden region, and there's a transition at the boundary between the two regions, which is at a turning point, and that is characteristically described by an Airy function. So I want to show you a nonlinear eigenvalue problem, and this is a problem that actually appeared in the book that Chris referred to. And when Orszag and I made up the problem, we didn't realize at all that it was a really very interesting problem. And so this is the problem that appears in the book. It's a trivial looking problem. It is just a first order differential equation with an initial condition, okay? And that's it. Just a trivial first-order equation. And if you make a plot, what you see is that the solutions do something interesting. The solutions are oscillatory for a while, and then there's a transition, and then the solutions become smoothly decaying. Okay? That's what the solutions look like. So there's an oscillation, there's a monotone decay, and a transition, and it looks a little bit like the solutions in linear quantum mechanics. Okay? So furthermore, the solutions do something interesting. You notice that the solutions bunch together here. All these solutions come together and approach a curve here. And then there's another bunch of solutions that come together and approach a curve, and so on. Okay, now you can ask, what is the asymptotic behavior of solutions for large x? And you can see very almost immediately that the solutions must behave like a constant over x. And why is that? Because if you look at this equation, if you take the derivative of 1 over x, the left side of the equation goes like 1 over x squared, so it vanishes rapidly. And if you choose the constant appropriately, the right side will vanish because x times y is a constant, and that constant must be an integer plus a half. Okay, that's obvious. Okay, so this is the asymptotic behavior where m is an integer, and you notice right away that there's a big problem. Okay, here's a blow up of the solutions. You see them coming together. Here are the solutions coming together, approaching these curves. And these curves are labeled by this integer m. But what you see is that the asymptotic behavior corresponds to m equals 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. And you can ask, where are the odd m solutions? Okay, where are they? Okay, that should be in the asymptotic behaviors, but they're not there. Okay, so that's the first puzzle. The second puzzle is that there is no arbitrary constant in the asymptotic behavior. This is a first-order differential equation. Where is the arbitrary constant? There should be one arbitrary constant, but it isn't there. Okay, and we looked very hard for it, and we thought maybe if we look in higher order, we will see an arbitrary constant. Okay, but if you look at all the terms in the asymptotic expansion, you see that there is no arbitrary constant in any order. Okay, all these terms in the asymptotic series depend on this integer m, but there is no arbitrary parameter. Okay, so I'm sorry?
M is arbitrary.
No, m is an integer. No. Solutions are labeled by m, but there must be a continuous parameter. There has to be an integration constant. So where is it? Okay? And so this is a very, very simple example of asymptotics beyond all orders. In fact, it's one of the simplest examples I've ever seen. So all you have to do is look at the difference. What we've said is that for all solutions in a given bundle, this is the asymptotic expansion in the mth bundle, okay? But if we look at the difference between two solutions in that bundle, they must be distinguished by an arbitrary constant, okay? We do a little bit of trigonometry, and we see that for large eigenvalue, large value of m, not eigenvalue, large value of m, that difference obeys a linear differential equation, and the solution to that linear differential equation is an exponential of x squared. It's a Gaussian. Okay? But it's interesting that depending on m, there's either a plus or a minus sign in this exponent. Okay? So this is the missing constant, and that constant multiplies something that is exponentially small. And that's where the constant is. The constant is what distinguishes between one solution and another solution in a bundle of solutions, in the mth bundle of solutions. Okay? So this is the invisible arbitrary constant. And what you can see is that odd m solutions are unstable, but even m solutions are stable. And if you go back and look more carefully, these are the unstable solutions, and they correspond to odd values of the integer m. Okay? And solutions near these move away. For example, this solution here, which is near this unstable solution, moves away very rapidly, like an e to the plus x squared. Okay? It moves very rapidly and joins this solution, which is stable. Okay, so solutions are attracted, they approach this limiting solution exponentially fast, like a Gaussian, and they move away from this unstable solution exponentially fast. Okay, so we have a bunch of unstable solutions. And what I want to do, and you can ask, where do these unstable solutions begin? They begin at these specific values, here, 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 and so on. And these solutions are unstable, and they begin at these numerical values here. And I want to call, just arguing by similarity or something, I would like to call these values eigenvalues, and I would like to call these separatrices, these unstable solutions, I would like to call them eigenfunctions, and I want to argue that these eigenvalues give rise to eigenfunctions. The eigenfunctions begin at the eigenvalues. Okay, so we wanted to know, we're physicists, okay, and we like to do WKB, and we like to ask, how do these eigenvalues behave for large M? Okay, so we calculated up to M equals 500,001, actually. And for large, if you let M equal 2N minus 1, for large N, the nth eigenvalue grows like the square root of m. Okay, so we expect it to grow like a power of n times a constant. And it, in fact, is very simple. It grows like the square root of n times a constant a. And we calculated that constant numerically as accurately as we could. And that was the fit that we got. That's the value of a. Okay? And then we guessed a. Okay? And a turns out to be 2 to the 5 sixths. Okay, it's not an obvious thing that you would guess, but that's the answer. And this is actually a rather non-trivial problem. If you want to prove that result, I'm not going to give you the proof, but if you're interested in the proof, it goes something like this. You take the solution to this problem, okay, and you scale it, and then you construct a double moment of the solution as an integral, okay? So it depends on two integers, okay? And then in the limit of large eigenvalue, these double moments actually satisfy a linear difference equation, which is over here, and this is a random walk problem, okay? And in fact, this is the boundary condition gives you a random walk problem with death, okay? You kill off the random walkers when they reach the origin, and you can solve that problem exactly. And from the solution, you can deduce this result. A is 2 to the 5 sixths. Okay? So this is something that, if you're interested in, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but in the question session, if you're interested, there is a very interesting connection to a very deep and unsolved pure mathematics problem, which refers to a constant p called the power series constant, which you may know about. This is an interesting issue in complex variable theory. This is a problem that was posed by Heyman, who was at Imperial College, in a problem book. And it is an unsolved problem. And p may very well be a deep and fundamental constant in the theory of complex variables. And it's a rather simple question. But nobody, in fact, knows the value of p. Okay, this is an unknown quantity, and this is the first few digits of A. The way we discovered, we didn't know about this branch of complex variable theory, but we used a very powerful research tool. We took this number and we Googled it. Okay, we just Googled 1.7818, and this theory came up, and we read some of the papers, and lots of interesting strong mathematicians have worked on it, Clooney and Erdős and Buchholz and so on. And the question, and at most, P is only known to this number of digits, even with all the modern computers that are available. And it may well be that P is precisely this number, 1.7818. What is only known are upper and lower bounds on the value of P. But I can tell you about that later. Okay, but this was just a trivial eigenvalue problem, and what I want to talk about here are extensions of that elementary problem, and I want to begin by talking about three non-trivial second-order non-linear differential equation eigenvalue problems, okay? And I want to begin by talking about some of the Panleve equations. As you know, there are six Panleve equations, and there are only spontaneous singularities or movable singularities or poles. Here are the equations, and I would like to begin by talking just about P1. This is the first Panleve transcendent, and it's second order, so you can give two initial conditions, for example, at the origin. And you can do some very trivial, very elementary asymptotics. You can ask, how does the solution behave as t goes to minus infinity? Minus infinity. So if t goes to minus infinity, there could be a dominant balance between this term and this term if this is negligible as t goes to minus infinity. So if you solve this equation, this is just a quadratic. You take the square root, and there's a plus or minus sign. So the solution either behaves like plus the square root of minus t or minus the square root of minus t, okay? And the solution has to choose, and it has a very difficult choice to make, okay? And so there are two possible asymptotic behaviors, and if you examine both of those asymptotic behaviors, you'll see that the negative square root of x is stable in the sense that the solution can just oscillate about it with gradually decaying oscillations. But the upper square root branch is unstable because nearby solutions either approach it exponentially fast or move away from it exponentially fast. And this is very well-known stuff. Okay? So these are some typical solutions. If I start, for example, by choosing the initial value of y to be 0, and I try different slopes, I will have a solution that either passes through an infinite number of second-order poles, or the solution may pass through a pole but eventually get attracted to the lower square root branch. Here's another solution that's just a sequence of poles, and here's another solution that oscillates about the lower branch. Okay, those are the typical kinds of behaviors of solutions. But you can ask, is it possible to find a solution that is unstable and that approaches this upper branch? And you can indeed, okay? So you can look for an initial, if you're starting at 0, you can look for an initial slope for which the solution is very delicate, but the solution approaches the upper branch, okay? And here is so this slope I will think of as an eigenvalue, and this solution I will think as an eigenfunction. Here's a solution that starts at a given precise value of the slope and approaches the upper branch, or the solution can go through, it can go down and then through one pole and approach this branch, or it could go down, up, and down and approach the branch, or it can have two poles and three poles and four poles. So the solutions are characterized by a number of poles and a number of dips, okay, and then only a finite number, and then it levels off and approaches infinity. In fact, these are some of the high eigenfunctions. This is the 10th and the 11th separatrix solution with an initial condition y of 0 equals 0, okay? Now, you can also take solutions with zero initial slope. That's a different class of eigenfunction solution, zero initial slope, but you can vary the initial condition, and if you get the right initial condition, you can get eigenfunctions like this. Okay? Well, so you have two different kinds of eigenvalue problems, zero initial slope or zero initial value, and if you look at the if you do what a physicist would do, let's look at the semi-classical limit, how do the eigenvalues behave for large eigenvalues. In the first case, where the initial slope, where the initial value is zero, the eigenvalues grow like n to the 3/5 power. And this is no surprise. You would expect it to be fifths. Okay, we know about this fifth is a characteristic of the first Pavlovian transcendent, times a constant, and numerically this is the constant. Okay? And if you take a zero initial slope, then you have the eigenvalues growing like n to the 2/5 times a constant. And again, this is the numerical value of the constant. This is what the higher order approximation looks like. Okay? I'm sure you've looked at these constants and guessed what they must be, okay, but if you haven't, this is what they are. This is the first constant, and that's the second constant. Okay? And it looks typically like the eigenvalues of a polynomial, of a typical polynomial in linear quantum mechanics, the kind of thing that you would get from a beta function calculation. Okay, and you can obtain that result analytically because, now I thought I was taking a vacation from PT symmetry when I was working on this problem, but to my shock, the way you find those constants is you observe that the first Pavlovian transcendent has a deep asymptotic connection with the cubic PT symmetric Hamiltonian. Do you remember the cubic PT? He doesn't remember it, but you do because you're smart, unlike our president. So there is a deep connection with this cubic PT symmetric Hamiltonian, and in fact, Pavlovian 1 corresponds to epsilon equals 1. The way you prove this, and I'll just give you a quick indication, is you take the Pavlovian equation, you multiply it simply by y prime, and you integrate. And if you do that, you obtain what people like to write down as the so-called Hamiltonian that gives rise to the Pavlovian transcendent, plus other terms. But of course, it's not an there's something left over, which is I of x, which is an integral that you can't do, of course. However, if you take x large, and you go off at an angle of pi over 4 in the complex plane, then you can show that I of x vanishes. Okay? And in fact, if you go off at this angle, that function I of x vanishes. And if I of x vanishes, then what you've been able to do is to relate this Hamiltonian at the point x to the same Hamiltonian at the point 0. Okay, so you can do asymptotics now. You can connect the initial conditions, either the initial position or the initial slope, the initial value or the initial slope, to the behavior at infinity. And that's the way you crack into the problem. Okay, in the case of the second Pavlovian transcendent, I'll just show you some pictures, but in the second Pavlovian transcendent, now you have you can look at the asymptotic behavior as x goes to minus infinity, and both of these solutions are unstable, but there's another solution, zero, another possible asymptotic behavior which is stable, and these are solutions that are not eigenfunctions, but these are solutions that are eigenfunctions, and you see the solutions alternate between approaching the lower branch of the square root, the upper branch, the lower branch, the upper branch, and these solutions develop one pole, two poles, three poles, four poles, and so on. So they're organized, and they're labeled by an integer n. And these are the 20th and 21st eigenfunctions, and you can see they have just a sequence of poles, and then this approaches the upper branch, or you have a sequence of poles, and it approaches the lower branch, and it oscillates between the two. Okay, and now, and here are additional solutions which I won't go into, but there are two, again, this is a second order equation, so you can study two different kinds of eigenvalue problems. Either you take the initial value to be zero and you let the slope be the eigenvalue, or else you take the initial slope to be zero and you take the initial value to be the eigenvalue, and in one case, the eigenvalues for large eigenvalue grow like n to the 2/3. In the other case, they grow like n to the 1/3 times constants, and these are the numerical values of the constants. Okay? And these are the actual analytic values of the constants. And what is interesting is that Panleve 2 corresponds to epsilon equals 2 in that PT symmetric class of quantum mechanics problems. Okay? So this is the quartic oscillator. So there's a deep connection between Panleve 2 and the quartic oscillator. You remember the upside-down quartic? He doesn't remember it, but you do. Okay. We also looked at the fourth Panleve transcendent, and I won't, these are some of the graphs, but I won't go through it in detail. But again, there are two different eigenvalue problems. The eigenvalues grow like n to the 3/4 and n to the 1/2 times constants, and these are the values of the constants, and to calculate those constants, you again show that this Panleve the fourth Panleve transcendent corresponds to the sextic PT symmetric Hamiltonian, the x to the sixth Hamiltonian. So that's the so the problem becomes linearized as you go to large eigenvalue. Okay? So apparently Panleve 1, 2, and 4 correspond to epsilon equals 1, 2, and 4 for reasons that are not immediately clear, but there's this very clear connection. Strange connection between PT symmetric quantum mechanics and the set of Panleves. Okay? But this analysis goes beyond that. Okay? These people are rather surprised about that fact, but you're not. Okay? So this goes beyond the Panleve equations. You can study something that we like to call super Panleve. Okay? These are a special class of equations that are extensions of the Panleve. So instead of y squared, we're going to have y to the power m and y to the power n here with an x. Okay. This is just one special class of equations. But what is special about this is that when you develop, when you look for a solution near a singularity, it sort of resembles a Laurent series. It isn't a Laurent series, of course. You know that. Panleve knows that. Okay. But it's a series in fractional powers of x, like in powers of x to the 1/3 or x to the 1/5. So that means that while the solution is not constrained to one sheet of a Riemann surface, it is constrained to n sheets of a Riemann surface. There's no logarithm, in other words, which is very nice. Okay. So again, we have studied the asymptotic behavior, and I'm not going to take the time to go through it, but these are a whole bunch of equations that belong to that class, and we have looked at the asymptotic behavior, and the asymptotic behavior has this typical structure, but there's, and here are lots of problems. You know, y to the 6 plus x, y to the 6 plus xy, y to the 6 plus xy squared, and so on, okay? So this generalizes to this very broad class of nonlinear differential equations, but there's one aspect that is kind of interesting here that is not present in the case of the Panleve transcendence. That when you go beyond the Panleve transcendence and look at these equations, so here are more examples, lots of examples, but when you look at these equations, well, as an example, take this equation, y to the fourth plus xy squared. Okay? When you take this equation, you find something that you have already seen in atomic physics. In atomic physics, you see fine structures. Okay, you can see in the energy spectrum, in the eigenvalue spectrum, you can see fine structure. And here you can see fine structure. So there are new hyperfine solutions that follow the eigenfunction y sub n, and then they deviate and oscillate m times. So this is yn, the nth eigenfunction, but they oscillate m times and approach about some curve, and then they approach another asymptotic limit. So they seem to be approaching one limit, then they go through a bunch of oscillations and approach a different limit. Okay, and that's the sort of, so they seem to be following this curve, and then they oscillate a bunch of times and then have a different asymptotic behavior, which is very interesting. And these eigenfunction, these eigenvalues exhibit a fine structure, namely that they are very, very finely separated. Okay, I mean, the separation of the eigenvalues is exponentially small. It goes like e to the minus 9, approximately, times an integer. Okay, so there, the distance between the eigenvalues is extraordinarily small. But we can fit this very, very carefully by doing very careful numerical analysis. Okay, so, well, so that is sort of a quick picture of what we've been doing. And we hope that we have opened a window to a new area of nonlinear semi-classical asymptotic analysis. Okay, thanks very much.
I just want to add some comment about this. You see, the similar phenomenon, actually, at some point I had also discovered this phenomenon, but in the case of Pinlevé 3, it's related with a similar problem. Pinlevé 3 related to the Mathieu equation at this point. Mm-hmm. And then I found in the literature that all this fact was known, actually, in about the 80s. The people who study Pinlevé in the context of his anomodromic deformation, they actually find these relations. And it
what relation?
Relation between the linear problem, you know, the spectrum of linear problems.
That's
and,
right.
And so the nonlinear Pinlevé equation.
Right. So people have known this. In fact, I didn't say it out loud in my talk, but there was a reference to the work of Massaro.
No. Okay, much earlier. Much earlier. 80s.
Right.
Massaro, it's much earlier.
Yes. I understand. I understand. That's fine. I have no problem with that. The point that I'm making is that there are these eigenvalue structures, okay, that you see solutions that are separatrix solutions and
right, but
emerge from eigenvalues.
Yeah, but this relation with Pinlevé and with the eigenvalue problems, it's facts. It's
okay, you'll have to show me. Cause
all right.
Also, for Pinlevé 1, indeed, there's a sort of mystery that there is a Stokes multiplier with a symmetry of order 5, and mm-hmm. it obeys exactly the same functional equation as the Stokes multiplier for the cubic potential, linear cubic potential. Now, but I'd never seen if the two Stokes multipliers are simply related to one another.
I assume that they are. I don't know, okay? I assume that they are. Right. I assume that they are because what I'm talking about here is an asymptotic. I mean, I don't know if they are, if you're not in an asymptotic region, but I assume that they must be if you are looking at the asymptotic behavior. So, you know, I don't know, but I assume that they must be.
Here's a more elementary question. So if, say I fix one of your examples that you worked on, and I'm looking for the initial conditions to give the nth eigensolution. Now that should, you looked at one, the derivative being zero or the first initial condition
yes,
being zero,
I
but
know
it'll
what,
cut out
I know
some
what
curve.
You're going to ask.
Of course. What is, do you get an interesting curve?
Yeah, so what you're asking is if you leave, if you look, so we've considered two extreme cases, okay? One where the derivative is zero and one where the initial condition is zero. And there must be some sort of, the answer is we don't know, okay? But obviously there must be some sort of uniform asymptotic approximation, okay? And that incorporates both cases. And there must be a way in which, for example, n to the 2/3 and n to the 1/3 go over into one another, okay? And
I mean,
how it does that? I agree. And that's an interesting problem, and we simply haven't looked at it yet. But we completely agree. We know that this is something that needs to be done.
I'm trying to comment somewhat about what you call PTA series, because my understanding might be a long one, but is that essentially when you have analytical continuation, and when we are talking about this is unstable potential like x minus x to the fourth, you can start from minus x squared, by the way, oscillator, long one. It's always, you are finding when you are putting this other condition in complex plane, it corresponds to a long certain line. You are dealing with this normal Hermitian Hamiltonian, and this Hermitian Hamiltonian, of course, has, you know, a real eigenvalues, and it's just
okay.
A different physical problem. So, mm-hmm. So if I consider a stable potential, my physical problem would be to find the creator.
Right.
If I consider that problem,
okay.
I agree that it would be, you know, a balanced state, and you would...
Yes.
So it might be a type of terminological issue, right? But this type of stuff appears even, for example, when you do Euclidean continuation. It's also, you can say that it is PT series, because...
I got it. I understand. So if you like, I will take 2 minutes and explain in what sense what's going on here. Can you raise the board? So the question is, for example, what do you mean by that Hamiltonian? So to begin with, you might say this is an unstable potential, okay? And normally we've been trained to say that is unstable, okay? But what you mean, okay, let me actually answer your question. What you mean when you say this is unstable is that this seems to be going down, okay? But what I'm doing is looking at quantum mechanics in the complex plane. And when you extend from real variables to complex variables, you lose everything about the complex number system is the same as the real number system, but you lose the ordering principle. You cannot say that one complex number is smaller than another complex number. So the simple use of the word unstable is not really appropriate. Now, what is going on here is this. This Hamiltonian, like all Hamiltonians, can have many different spectra. And it depends how you construct this Hamiltonian and how you define the spectrum, okay? So there are many ways of obtaining this Hamiltonian, but two possible ways are to start with the Hamiltonian p squared plus x squared and put in a parameter a, and let a in the complex plane go from positive a to negative a. Another way to construct the Hamiltonian is to start with this harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian, and multiply this by ix to the epsilon, okay? And now let epsilon go from 0 to 2. And when you do this continuation, you end up with this Hamiltonian. When you do this, you also end up with this Hamiltonian, but with different boundary conditions. And in the first case, the Hamiltonian you obtain is this. This is unstable. Okay, it is parity symmetric. Okay, so this is a parity symmetric Hamiltonian, but it has complex eigenvalues and corresponds to unstable solutions. In this case, when you end up with the same Hamiltonian, but it is not invariant under parity, even though it looks like this Hamiltonian goes into itself under x goes to minus x, it doesn't. Okay, it doesn't. It has to do with the boundary conditions on the eigenfunctions. Okay. Now, to understand intuitively what is happening here, it's very easy to understand, and you can understand at the classical level, and I can explain it in 1 minute. Okay, just intuitively. So you start with the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian. Okay, and you. You can ask, you know, at the level of freshman physics, how does this, just classically, how does it behave? You consider a particle of energy E. This particle, you have a potential here, that's a quadratic potential, and the particle is moving back and forth in this potential with energy E, okay? So here is the x-axis, here is x equals 0, here's the turning point, here's the other turning point, and the particle moves back and forth between the turning points. And that seems to be the end of the story. But you can ask, what happens if we start with a particle over there? Okay, now, normally, if you ask your teacher, what happens if you start with a particle initially over there, the teacher will say, you can't put a particle over there classically, because in that case, x is bigger than the square root of e. So x squared is bigger than e, so p squared is negative. P squared cannot be negative, so therefore that's called the classically forbidden region. But we can still solve, we can put the particle over here, okay, because since p squared is negative, it means that the velocity of the particle is in the imaginary direction. So let's extend the real axis to the complex plane, and let's ask, where does the particle go? Okay, and the particle, in fact, goes in an ellipse like this, okay, and the turning points are actually the foci of the ellipse, so the turning points play a larger role than you might have expected. This is always an ellipse, like that, always, okay, and so you have a bunch of nested ellipses, okay, and what you see, in fact, is that this back and forth motion is not really back and forth. It's a degenerate ellipse that's going above and below the branch cut here. Furthermore, the amount of time it takes for a particle to go around an ellipse is always the same. Okay? Now, you can ask the following question. This looks like an unstable potential. Okay? The potential looks like this. And if you give a particle this much energy, E, okay, and you let the particle go, it will drift off to infinity, but now it raises an interesting question because it reaches infinity in finite time. And where you can ask, where does it go next? And using real analysis only, you can't answer that question. What happens at where is the particle at t plus 1? But if we try to answer this question by taking this potential and multiplying it by ix to the epsilon and gradually increasing epsilon, This situation smoothly deforms, and these turning points move down into the complex plane, and the picture looks like this. Now the turning points are here. And if you start a particle at the turning point, it goes back and forth. And if you start a particle near the turning point, it goes around like this. Okay? So you have a deformed version of this ellipse. Okay? And now you ask, what happens if I approach the real axis? Okay, and as you approach the real axis, these become bigger and bigger and bigger. And just as you approach the real axis, the particle, all these, the period of the motion is always the same. The particle goes off to infinity. Okay, it immediately zips around to minus infinity and comes back up to the origin. Okay, now the probability classically of finding the particle is, you know, the probability density of finding the particle is proportional to 1 over the velocity of the particle. So if you ask, where is the particle most likely to be found, it's most likely to be found at the origin. And if you draw a probability plot of the particle, it looks like this. It's sharply peaked about the origin classically. Okay? So this is in a classical bound state. It is statically unstable, of course. I don't disagree with that. But it is dynamically stable, okay, and the particle is most likely to be found at the origin, okay, and so this is sort of a Feynman-Wheeler boundary condition at infinity, okay, and if you now quantize the system, the only thing that changes is that this probability density has a bunch of oscillations that look like this, okay, but the particle is in a confined bound state, so a minus x to the 4 potential is stable, and for that matter, a minus phi to the 4 field theory is also stable. So this is the field theory that you obtain in the double scaling limit, and in fact, there isn't anything wrong with that theory. It has a bound state.
Not massive moment, what they're saying, but if you take away, take it, and you look what will you do away, take it, you will see that it moves pretty good in quantum mechanics as well.
Okay. I think we'll keep that question for after.
Okay, but love to chat with you. Yeah.